When you need to work quickly and confidently across different apps and platforms, consistent quality communication is key. Whether you're writing documents, emails, or presentations, you need Grammarly. It's an AI writing partner that helps you get your work done faster with better writing. It's always there to help because it works where you work, across 500,000 apps and websites, so you can get more done no matter where you're writing. Grammarly is the gold standard of responsible AI, trusted by millions of professionals for 15 years. It gives you personalized writing suggestions based on your audience, goals, and context, plus tone suggestions to help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. 96% of users agree Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Today's podcast is sponsored by The Morning Navigator, a daily newsletter written by Tony Greer, who is a 30-year veteran trader in the financial markets. Now, you know that I would not accept a sponsorship from something that I couldn't endorse. I think it's really important to be responsible with your personal finances and investments, and to do that, you need to understand the financial markets. This is where The Morning Navigator fills a specific need for me. If you're trying to find actionable trade ideas or simply educate yourself about the markets, then The Morning Navigator will help you do both. Tony's hit ratio for filling me in on things I should know about is extremely high. The Morning Navigator makes complicated finance topics easy to understand, even if you're a beginner. You can sign up for a free trial right now at tgmacro.com. Now, the newsletter subscription normally costs $60 a month or $650 per year, but my listeners can get $100 off an annual subscription by using the code ZUBY at checkout. That is the discount code ZUBY, Z-U-B-Y, at checkout. You can sign up for a free trial today, once again, at tgmacro.com. Go check it out.
I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram, stunt me, destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like Obain, click and I bang, y'all gon' remember the name.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with ZUBY podcast. On today's episode, we have got on Cynthia Thurlow, who is a nurse practitioner, a nutrition expert, and she is also a 2x TEDx speaker. So welcome to the show, Cynthia. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. My kids just went back to school for the first time in 2 weeks, so I'm having a really good morning.
Awesome. And how is your 2020 kicking off?
Amazing. You know, there's so many, I think it's all about mindset, but I rolled into 2020 saying, you know, 2019 kicked my behind, you know, backwards and forwards. But yeah, 2020 is starting off absolutely on the right foot.
Awesome. So I've done a really brief intro of some of your accolades right there, but why don't you tell the audience a little bit more about who you are?
Yeah. So I worked as a Western medicine trained nurse practitioner for 16 years in cardiology. And when I became a parent, which is now a long time ago, my oldest child developed life-threatening food allergies. And that really got me interested in kind of looking at how food influences our health. You know, most traditionally Western medicine trained providers really don't think about the connections between food and our health. And so for me, it was really deep diving into, you know, the processed food industry, really looking at the way our foods are prepared, how they come to our supermarkets or our grocery stores. And so, you know, that then led to being more interested in the impact of food on our health than writing prescriptions. And so almost 5 years ago, I left clinical medicine to become an entrepreneur. And I wasn't entirely sure at the beginning what that really would look like. And so that has evolved into seen now as a health expert within, you know, kind of the nutrition realm. And I still have my hands in Western medicine. And obviously now I've got this functional training as well. But for me, it's really evolved into looking at health and wellness very differently than I did when I was in my training many years ago. And so there's still obviously a place for Western medicine. I'm not at all identifying that that's not the case. But I just think when we're looking at prevention and we're looking at overall health and wellness, the food that we have on our fork is far more important and impactful than we have given it the credit for previously. And so it evolved into that. And then, from there, becoming an entrepreneur, which was obviously a departure that I didn't entirely expect, kind of evolved into, I'm an introvert and I like to challenge myself. And so, in 2018, I decided that the scariest thing I could think to do that was within a self kind of realm was to do a TED Talk. And so I executed my first one in Toronto in December of 2018. And then right around the same time, I got a second one. And then in between those two events, I went on vacation with my husband and came back and was gravely ill. I almost died last February. And I still decided to do that second TED Talk. And the beauty of all of that is from there, my life has gotten very, very rich. I think when, you get to a point where, your health is really on the line and you've taken it for granted, as I think most people do, until they get sick or until someone they love gets very, very sick. Even healthcare providers, we take a lot of that for granted. So what's evolved from that is just a deeper appreciation, much more spiritual connection, not only for myself, but with, the world and the impact that I want to make. As I continue to be very, very grateful that I am still here walking the earth. And then, a really deep and profound connection. I have two boys and I have two dogs who are being quiet right now, for which I'm very, very grateful. But yeah, that's the space I exist in. I like to talk about food. I like to talk about the impact of food on people's health and wellness. And I love that, a lot of my traditionally Western medicine trained peers, love to refer to me. And I always say, I'm happy to bounce people back. If they need a prescription, I'm happy to send them back to you. But I really want to just focus on the food. It all starts with food.
Gotcha. So when you say Western medicine, do you just mean what most people would call medicine?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you go to your doctor, you've got a cough, they'd ascertain, what do you need? Do you need an antibiotic? Do you need cough suppressants, cough expectorants, those kinds of things. But yes, what we traditionally think of.
Okay. So like non sort of Chinese medicine or
Correct. Pathic
stuff kind of thing. Okay. I get you. And so tell us a little bit more about the story of what happened last year. I mean, what happened? You said that you got very ill, you almost died. I mean, what specifically happened there?
Yeah. So we got back from, I accompanied my husband on a business trip, got home and, developed what I would liken to say, pain worse than labor. So I clearly knew something was very, very wrong. Because I would never go to the emergency room unless I felt like I was dying. And so I showed up and initially, because I didn't look all that bad, I don't think they took me very seriously. But when they got lab work back and then they ordered a stat CAT scan, they realized that my appendix had ruptured. And so when that happens, you can create a constellation of complications. And so at the time that evening, they actually couldn't take me to surgery. I was too sick. The entire length of my colon was inflamed. And they said, if we go in for surgery, they're going to take your entire colon. And I said, no, I need that. Mm. And so I was hospitalized and, crossing our fingers, I got septic, which means I got a blood infection. On top of that, I got a small bowel obstruction, which means, it was like the domino effect. My body was ensuring I wasn't consuming any foods.
Yeah.
I then developed abscesses in my abdomen, which meant I had to have a special drain. I mean, I was in the hospital for 2 weeks and there was definitely a day when the surgeon who had known me for many years came in and here's a tip. Most surgeons have no interest in coming in to see their patients multiple times a day. If you see your surgeon multiple times a day as a patient, you're pretty sick. And so it was the third time she had been in to see me. And she mentioned, she said, I just don't know why you're not getting better. I'm genuinely concerned. And there was absolutely a moment that same day where I was very despondent and very depressed, which is not my personality at all. And understandably, no one wants to be in the hospital. So it's not surprising you would get this situational depression and feel, really kind of sad and bad for yourself. And I felt a tremendous spiritual presence that was giving me the option of, this could go one of two ways. And what's your choice? And very clearly, I'm a parent and I felt like my boys are way too young to not have a mom. And so it was a very conscious effort that if I was going to survive this hospitalization and survive being so sick and being so ill, that I was going to make the most of everything I did. And it was this also this awareness of I'm not fearing anything anymore. You know, I think all of us, even confident, strong, self-assured individuals like ourselves, definitely have things that you may not, you know, gravitate towards, you may fear, you may not look forward to. And, you know, from that hospitalization and that recovery and going on to do that second talk, I fear nothing. I mean, I tell people that all the time, that I just really want to live my life fearlessly. Whereas before, I probably played it a little safe. You know, it's the typical, you know, I did everything my parents expected me to do. And, you know, the last few years have been veering off course from what was expected, doing something that's different. But now I truly want to live my life differently than I did before, and to not be afraid to take chances and to not be afraid to do things that maybe wouldn't work for someone else. Mm-hmm. But really, you know, demonstrating for my children that your mindset is absolutely everything. I mean, that's what got me on that stage, because I was still pretty sick when I did that talk. So,
yeah, no, that's super powerful. I mean, being aware of one's own mortality, whatever causes that, there's not really any bigger motivator than that. It's something that, like, I tell people often. I mean, it might sound a little bit morbid, but I'm one of those people who I got a lot of people, I'm connected to a lot of people now. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people ask me, like, man, how do you stay so motivated? How do you keep going and whatever? And part of it, of course, is the fact that I want to inspire and have a positive impact on other people. Mm-hmm. But also sometimes I tell people, like, yo, like, I know I'm going to die. Mm-hmm. Like, that might sound dark, that might sound sad or whatever, but it's like, look, I don't know, like, I'm from a very big family. Mm-hmm. And being from a very big family, like both immediate family and wider family, I mean, I've got 50 first cousins and
wow,
dozens of aunts and uncles and everything like that, and I'm on the younger end of the thing, like, in terms of my own generation anyway. And as a result of that, it means in the past 15 years, I've seen a lot of death.
Yeah.
Right. As everyone gets older, and people get sick, people get into their 80s and their 90s and their 100s. So it's like, for the past decade, I've seen a lot of people pass away. Right. I've seen my cousins' parents passing away. I've seen many of my cousins pass away. Some of them younger than my age when they did. You know, I've had a cousin who had sickle cell anemia and stuff like that. So I've seen that. And, you know, then my own friends, I've seen people pass away. And then people I don't even know, but you hear stories, you see things in the news, you see all this. And I'm just like, man, life is not, you know, tomorrow is not, it's not promised today. Like, hopefully we go on and live for a super duper long time, but it's not guaranteed. And so a lot of what drives me in everything, and even in the way I try to treat other people, is just having that knowledge somewhere in my head that, you know what, like, it's not guaranteed, like, stuff is not guaranteed. And yeah, I think it sounds morbid, but it's actually like a very positive way to view the world.
Right.
And I think it makes you treat better people better too. You value people more. If you love people, you show them you love them. You tell them you love them. Cause it's like, I don't know, you know, there's going to be one time where it's the last time you see that person or you talk to that person, and you don't know, like, you just don't know. So yeah, like, don't expect the worst, of course not, but just be aware and be conscious of it. And I think if you are, then it leads to a much better mindset and mentality.
I agree. I mean, life is all about not playing small. You know, I took my then 11-year-old with me to my second talk, and he thought it was the coolest experience ever. He's kind of like a little old man in an 11-year-old's body. The things that stimulate him and that are of interest to him are probably not what is of interest to the average 11-year-old. And the conversations that we had out of that were so powerful. And I kept emphasizing how important it is to not feel like you have limitations, to, you know, do what you think you can do. And I said, you know, my body was not ready for me to do that talk, but my brain was. Mm-hmm. And that was so important. And I said, and I think it's even more important that that was part of my mental recovery, was saying, okay, I'm still going to execute this talk, even though I knew the curators thought I was bananas. They were very supportive, but they kept saying, we don't want you to compromise your recovery. I said, no, my surgeon has allowed me to fly with a ruptured appendix, do my talk, come home, and then have my surgery. And so, you know, really telling my children, you know, if you set your mind to something, you can absolutely do it. And that's how powerful that is. But I agree with you. After many years of working in healthcare and seeing you know, thousands and thousands of patients, you know, the one thing that I heard consistently, irrespective of age, from people that were dying or were chronically terminally ill, was they would say, I would have lived more. I would have feared less. I would have done more. And so, you know, very much, even though I was caring for them, it didn't make as much of an impact until I got ill. But those influences of our family, I'm from a large Italian family, not nearly as many cousins as Zuby, but they do make a profound impact on you as you see generations, you know, age. And some people, you know, seem to embrace getting chronologically older with more vigor than others. You know, some people live in a world of pessimism. And so I always say to my boys, you know, I want to be an example of how to, you know, age in a way that, you know, you continue to embrace life and have energy and have a great quality of life. Cause that's really what it's all about.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as long as you're getting better in some way, shape or form, then I don't think people should really fear aging. I mean, we live in a time where, I mean, I do think realistically, I think that's something that women seem to fear more than men do, sort of on average. And I understand that to some degree. But I think as long as you're, I think a lot of people fear aging because they're not really improving or they don't feel like they're improving, right? So they're kind of stuck in this one place. I mean, you go to school, maybe you go to university, you get a job. And then for some people, it kind of, it almost stops there, right? Yes. They stop reading books, they stop learning new things, they stop traveling or meeting new people, right? Like some people, I mean, they literally stop meeting new people pretty much once they hit, I don't know, their early 20s. And then from then on, it's just all the people they've known. I mean, I guess I'm quite grateful in a way with what I do that by definition, I'm constantly, literally every day, just meeting people, new people, offline, online, traveling around. And so with me, like, I don't know, every birthday or whatever, like, I'm like, cool. Like, when I'm 50, like how much am I going to know? Do you know what I mean?
Like,
I look back 10 years ago and I think of how much better of a man I am now than I was 10 years ago. And I'm like, wow, like imagine the next 10, right? Cause I'm going to keep getting better. Like I'm going to keep, I'm going to keep training. I'm going to keep my nutrition on point. I'm eventually going to, be married and have a family and start that whole new process of, now I'm an uncle to 9 children.
Wow.
But that started 13 years ago because I'm also the youngest in my family. I'm the youngest of 5. So I'd never seen other people really growing up until I became an uncle when I was 20. Fun. And then once I became an uncle and then became an uncle 8 more times, it's like, oh, cool. Like I've now got like a new title and a new role and I'm now in that different position. So it's like in the future, then I'll be a father. Like right now I'm sitting there taking notes, you know,
but, that's smart to do that. Yeah.
But yeah, it's like, so I'm excited about the future. I'm excited about getting older. It's not like maybe when I'm like 70 and I'm like, oh, okay. My body is, you know, starting to, to like significantly deteriorate or something, then I'd be a bit more worried. But even then, I mean, my dad is 73 and firstly, he doesn't look it, and
he doesn't. He
certainly does not act it. My dad is having a great time, so I personally don't fear it too much, you know.
Yeah, it sounds like you've got a great family that's kind of role modeled behavior, and I think that's really key. You know, being a lifelong learner, recognizing that, you know, when you leave university or leave graduate school or leave a job, I mean, we should be learning our entire lives. I tell my boys that as much as they in their minds think I'm going to go to graduate school and then I don't have to ever be a student again. And I said, you will always be a student. I will always be a student. I'm always learning. I'm a gigantic, you know, nerdy, geeky person, but people sometimes make this assumption. They just make assumptions about people based on the way they look that, oh, you can't possibly be. Oh, yes, I can. I showed you all the books I have on my floor that I'm in the midst of reading, but I agree with you that, you know, that role modeling behavior is so critical. I mean, I'm my mom's family, this very large Italian family, which is all about, you know, love and togetherness and family, and my aunts, how they demonstrate that for the younger generations. There are 15 of us.
Okay.
So a little bit smaller than your cousin family, but, you know, for me, huge, huge emphasis on, you know, that connectiveness and, you know, making sure that you're staying in touch with one another and supporting one another. And I think that's, you know, something that in many ways is lacking in this kind of over-harried society that we're all residing in, where people are disconnected. You know, it's always something I'm tweeting about, is how disconnected people are and how do we get more connected? And it's like, get off electronics and get some sunshine. And it seems kind of trite, but it's so true. It's like, get back to basics, stop eating so much processed food, and, you know, do things that are better for your body and your mind. You know, we're all turning, our brains are going to all turn to Swiss cheese because people are connected to their iPads and watching Netflix, you know, on repeat 24/7. And I'm not knocking that that can sometimes be something that might be fun if you need to decompress. But the point being, that shouldn't be like where we get our information, you know, is the predominant source.
It's a strange oxymoron, isn't it? That we're simultaneously more connected than ever, but also more disconnected than ever, right? You can, like, loneliness seems to be, I don't know about an all-time high, but a past few decades high, yet people are probably connected to and interacting with more other people than before. But whether you're talking about friendships or romantic relationships or, you know, parent-child relationships, all of that stuff, it's become, I mean, there's so many factors involved there, but it's like some of those bonds have been weakened in some cases or broken in other cases, despite the fact, we have got all this amazing technology and the fact that we can do this podcast and we can communicate on Twitter, and I can be in the UK, you can be in America, and we're here talking real time. We can see each other. It's basically magic. So when it comes to, you know, the internet and social media in particular, firstly, it's interesting because I think whether or not people realize it, I think we're sort of, the past 13 years, we've basically been in one of the biggest sort of human experiments that's never been done before. And I don't think people really think about this. Like, we don't really know what all the long-term effects of all of this stuff is. And thus far it looks pretty negative. At least for the average person, it looks pretty negative if you sort of look at the statistics. And then, of course, you couple that with other things. Of course, we can talk more about exercise and diet and nutrition and all that, which, again, you have more abundance than ever before. If you live in the Western world, I mean, you go to the supermarket. I was in the States last year, and I was looking at just the amount of different types of milk. I was in the supermarket, and I was like, this is insane. There are like 40 kinds of milk. You know what I mean? Like this is ridiculous. How can there be this many options? Like, they have milk from fruits and nuts and vegetables I didn't even know you could get milk from. And then you had like your 0.5%, 1%, 1.5%, 2%. I was just like, good grief. Lacto-free, soy, milk, soy, cashew, almond, hazelnut. I was just like, this is crazy. But yeah, given that, it's just weird because, you know, again, people are more sedentary than before. People are making worse food choices than before. Yeah, it's a weird one. I do think in the modern Western world, a lot of the problems that we have are now problems of abundance rather than problems of lack. There are problems of lack that still exist, of course. You've still got homelessness issues in cities. You've still got certain places where, you know, people are struggling to get enough, you know, to afford certain foods and whatever. But, you know, and of course, healthcare. But generally, if you look at the most of the problems, you look at what people are anxious about, you look at what people are depressed about or facing other mental health issues with, a lot of it sort of stems in abundance. It doesn't stem in lack. It's, you know, even people's relationships and stuff. Like, I think a lot of that is just, there's too much out there. Like, you know, so people just kind of get lost in this matrix of just, I don't know, this swiping and swiping and swiping and going on this and going on that and connecting to this and connecting to that. But then it's harder for two people to just kind of sit there and look each other in the eye and have a conversation.
It's that authentic connection that, you know, you kind of inferred earlier. And obviously, let's be honest, I'm in my 40s, so I wasn't part of the Tinder experience. But, you know, I do with fascination / concern, you know, genuinely, both for both genders. I think it's this kind of instant gratification society that we're kind of creating, where these get these dopamine hits. I'm sure it's no different than when you're, you know, going through Instagram or Twitter or Facebook, you know, whatever social media platform you're on, looking at Tinder, and you just start to wonder, are we actually rewiring our brains in such a way that we can't enjoy simple pleasures anymore because we want that instant dopamine hit? And we know dopamine is a neurotransmitter. We recognize the impact it has on our brain, and it creates this kind of pleasure cycle. And so, you know, that's certainly one issue. I could probably talk about that forever because I just find it fascinating. But then, you know, on the flip side, I did most of my medical training in Baltimore, and having been a suburban girl my entire, you know, existence, living in Baltimore was without a doubt one of the most impactful experiences in my entire life. I lived there for 7 years. I had never seen that degree of abject poverty, the homelessness issue, the addiction problems, teen pregnancy, you name a issue. At that time, it was the height of the HIV crisis. Mm-hmm. And back then, people didn't live.
What sort of years was that?
Oh, a long time ago. So 1997 okay. through 2003, okay. Which will give you an idea of our age differences. But the point being, for me, it was one of the best things that could have ever happened to me because I feel like it broke me of that kind of, you know, and I'm not saying it's just Americans, but a lot of Americans. I hadn't traveled a lot abroad at that point in my life, hadn't really seen how other people lived. I want to talk about something that like brings you to your knees because I would go to work or I would be in clinicals or I'd be in my training, and our medical school campus was in the inner city. It wasn't in the, you know, the suburbs of Baltimore. You know, they had what I would call a cop in a box. And so on every street corner, there was a cop with a gun. And literally in a box. And so they could monitor everything that was going on. But that was there because there was safety issues. Mm. And so they would make recommendations for students, most of which, including myself, were clueless. And I, of course, you know, being a rule follower, did everything they recommended and did fine. But people would sometimes wander off campus and they would get into trouble. But one of the things that struck me was the first time I was in a patient's home, and they had, you know, very little access to healthy foods. And by this, I mean, you know, they participated with a program called WIC. And so they would take their WIC coupons, and what they would find is what they could buy the most of for themselves and their family were these highly processed, highly addictive foods. Mm. And you start to kind of wonder and put all these things together that, you know, we create these programs to be helpful, but we are then creating a whole generation of people that are addicted to foods that are not benefiting them. I mean, it's nutrition, but it's like nutrition-like substances. And so, you know, I 100% agree that, you know, in a society where there is an overabundance of stuff and food, there are so many people that really lack like the basic resources to be able to provide an environment that would be setting them up for any degree of success. And that for me was something that was profoundly life-altering. Mm. We talk about time periods in our lives where you just have snippets. And I always say I had the greatest experiences being in Baltimore, and I'm forever indebted to the patients and my fellow students and my professors. But it also completely shifted my perspective, you know, having been that naive kind of suburban girl, to then kind of evolve into a person who was highly philanthropic, very interested in giving back, recognizing that that's truly a path to happiness and wellness. And, you know, giving back is something that I think a lot of people, maybe they don't grow up feeling that way, but they evolve as a human being and recognize that, you know, if you have abundance, meaning, you know, if you can sponsor a family, or that's what I did, even though I was a poor student, I would sponsor a family every single, you know, Christmas time and buy jackets. And I would say to myself, can you imagine someone not being able to have enough money to buy their kid a winter coat? Yeah. Like no one should go without a coat or a hat. Those kinds of things. But yeah, I agree. There's definitely this abundance, and then there's this lack, and we need to be cognizant of it.
Yeah, definitely. And awesome. That's what you did there and what you say you do there. That's fantastic. I think more and more people need to, you know, do that kind of thing. Look out for other people, give back. And, you know, it's easy to think of how to, I think again, with the way society is right now, I think most people's minds are set on taking and receiving, mm-hmm. rather than on giving. And the funny thing, I mean, of course, you're an entrepreneur, so you'll understand this. And the funny thing with entrepreneurship and with business is, even from a perspective of making money or doing well for yourself, you do that by providing value to other people, mm-hmm. in various ways, whether that's through making a podcast people want to listen to, or writing a book people wish to read, giving a talk that people want to listen to, teaching people something that helps them, helping them with their nutrition, helping them with their fitness, helping them with their health. All of these are things that, you know, people will pay money for, things that provide them with value. So one big shift I had a couple of years ago was just that sort of realization. I guess it's something I understood implicitly, but even with my own music and stuff, like, I did always want to make music that would inspire people and they could take something positive from. But when I was younger, I mean, I started rapping when I was 18. And when I first kind of got into it, I was thinking, like, you know, it was a more me-centric view. Mm-hmm. It was like, okay, I want to do this because I want to get this, or I want that, I want this. Whereas now I think from a perspective, oh, okay, this is my skill set. This is my expertise. These are the things I have to offer the world. Okay, what can I do to help people in this regard? I mean, that's why I wrote and released my fitness book, Strong Advice, last year. At the beginning of the year, I had no plans to write a book, but I was like, you know what? I'm an expert at this. Why don't I create something? Why don't I take all this knowledge I've gained over the past 17 years and just put something out that'll help people reach their goals? I've done it for myself. I used to be overweight and I've gone through this journey. So why don't I just do that? And with everything I do now, that's kind of where my head is at. I'm always kind of thinking, okay, what else can I offer people? What else can I give people? How can I do this better? How can I do that better? And lo and behold, by shifting that mindset, it turns out that even from a kind of business or a career standpoint, things started going way better. The more people you can help, then the more it also helps you. That shouldn't necessarily be the core reason you do it, but it's just it's a total win-win. And it seems a lot of people don't, I mean, you can tell that a lot of people don't really understand that, because you have also got this mentality a lot of people have where they feel, you know, that envy or jealousy. They'll see someone who's like, at the moment, everyone's gunning for the billionaires right now, right? So it's like, oh, these billionaires. Yeah. And it's like, I tweeted about this the other day. It's like, you're using your iPhone created by a billionaire on an operating system created by a billionaire, on a social media platform created by a billionaire, to complain about billionaires whilst probably like sipping your drink that's made by a billionaire.
Right, exactly. No, right? Brilliant.
So I'm like, if you were serious, like, why don't you just boycott all these
right, but companies? They won't.
And it's like, no. And it's like, well, those people became billionaires by offering something that millions, if not billions, of people want and use. So if you kind of reframe it that way, rather than thinking that they just ran around robbing everybody, which they didn't do, then you'll think, oh, actually, I can take a lesson from that.
Correct.
And yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about nutrition, because I know that's certainly within, I know that's kind of one of your main wheelhouses right there. So let me frame it this way. What is the one thing, or you can give me more than one. What's the one thing about nutrition that most people get wrong, or most people should know but don't know?
I could go a couple different directions, but I think the thing that has become most apparent to me over the last 20 years is that in our kind of westernized societies, we think of food as comfort and not as fuel. Mm. And that distinction is so critical for so many reasons, because when we think of food as fuel, I know it's not sexy. You know, people, you know, to me, it's a means to an end. I have to sit down and I have to eat a meal. I intermittent fast and I have two meals during my day, but it's a means to an end. It's something I do. I sit down, I enjoy my meal. I'm relaxed. I'm in a, you know, relaxed state. But what most people do is they've been conditioned to crave foods when they're not feeling great, whether it's emotional or physical. And so this again gets into this highly addictive, highly processed, highly excited toxin kind of foods. And so it sets up, you know, this unfortunate relationship with food where it's no longer about fuel, it's about comfort. And that's a really important distinction that I think most people don't make, or they will tell me, well, I'm carb addicted and that's just the way things are. And I look like, that's a limiting belief and that's a whole other issue. But I would say that's probably the biggest issue, because if I can get someone to believe food is fuel, they are going to consume different types of food and they're going to make better food choices. Whereas if someone says, I had a really bad day at work and I downed a gallon of ice cream and ate a whole pizza, and I'm like, and then you're going to feel horrible afterwards. Not to mention, you know, putting carbohydrates and fats together is, you know, like the perfect way. It's like the perfect storm to be like super, super addictive. And then your brain doesn't give the proper cues that your body is full. And therefore it just starts this cycle of, I then want to have 10 chocolate bars and I then want to have another gallon of ice cream. And so I think that's probably where I start with most people. And it's really, you know, the other big issue is, again, because of this, you know, highly stimulated environment that we live in, we don't really sit down for our meals. Like when I travel to Europe, and I think of Spain in particular, people have these long, long meals and it's wonderful and people enjoy their food and they savor it. And we have gotten so far away from not only cooking our own meals, but savoring, enjoying, and just allowing ourselves to spend an hour eating a meal. Whereas, you know, most Americans, they want to get in and they want to get out. I just snapped my fingers. You know, they want to sit down at a restaurant. They want the waiter to come over immediately. They want to get their food in 10 minutes. They want to have their check-in in, you know, under an hour. And so we just have a different relationship with food. And one important distinction is you cannot be stressed. And so stressed is where most of us are eating. We're in our cars, we're yelling at our kids, we're on the go, we're having an argument with someone that we work with, and we're eating food. And if you're stressed, your body can't digest. You know, you have two major, you know, nervous systems, parasympathetic and sympathetic. And so you can't be in the rest and repose side of your body if you're stressed and arguing. And so I remind people that you really do need to sit down and not be distracted by technology and not be, you know, doing all the things I mentioned, being in your car or, you know, standing up and eating at work, which I was guilty of a few years ago out of necessity. But the point being, you can't properly digest your food. And so you have all these people that are taking reflux medications and, you know, they're bloated all the time. And I'm like, well, you ate a meal that should have been eaten over 20 minutes and five, and you're eating a lot of crap. And so this is, you know, it just starts up this kind of very circuitous situation. So I'd say those are a couple of like the main things that I see that are of huge concern. And a lot of the work that I do is just teaching like really basic stuff to people. And then when they start, you know, looking at food differently and they're satiated and they're, you know, taking more than 5 minutes to eat a meal, they suddenly start to feel a whole lot better. And then that is like the domino effect. Then you really start doing a lot of fine tuning.
And it's amazing how it's like magic to people, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
For people who are, you know, in the fitness world or nutrition world in any way, or who have, you know, got a, I don't say a decade plus experience in that regard, there's so much stuff, both when it comes to the gym and when it comes to nutrition, that seems so obvious to us, right? So I get people, you know, asking me advice on, you know, fat loss or building muscle or whatever. And sometimes I'll tell them something and it's like, it just blows their mind. Like, and I'm like, oh gosh. And I was, because it's easy to forget, you know, I started going to the gym when I was like 15,
That's awesome.
Yeah, I used to play rugby.
So, man, that's a brutal sport.
Yeah. So I started training primarily to get bigger and stronger for rugby. And I used to just, I used to get all my info from the bodybuilding magazines and just, go through and try to mimic the workouts. And I used to eat way too much food just in general, right? I was on that, oh gosh, if I don't eat protein for 2 hours, I'm going to go catabolic all my muscles are going to fall off. Like, I weighed more when I was 15 than I weigh now.
That's amazing.
that's how much I was eating. Yeah.
And I mean, it's amazing because there's a lot of dogma that people don't want to let go of. And that's a lot of the work that I do is saying to people, it's okay if you don't eat breakfast. It's okay if you're not eating every 2 hours. And I don't, in fact, want you to eat every 2 hours because the more frequently you eat, the more insulin you secrete. And the more insulin you secrete, the more likely you are to pack on weight. And so, you know, trying to explain to people, but yeah, but you have evolved much like I have evolved. Like I said to someone the other day, I found my happy place. Like I do really well eating the way that I do. And I know I recognize for a lot of other people that would seem weird, but it works for me and I'm happy. And really that's what it comes down to, is finding what works for you and your body and your lifestyle and doesn't seem to be too restrictive, which, you know, it's all relative. But I agree that, you know, we all try to evolve and change and try to find the things that work best for our bodies. And, you know, those that don't, like I say to people all the time, I'm like, I don't do really well doing a lot of carbs, but for other people, they may have a higher carb tolerance, but that's okay. Right. And you're a young man and you're 30. So you have more of a threshold. Whereas women, unfortunately, as we get older, we have to be like more carb focused, meaning, you know, we just can't eat as much. We want high quality, but not like you're going to have a sweet potato, but you're not going to have a pound of French fries. So it's all about like really thinking through those decisions can make a big impact.
Yeah. I mean, there was something you said there earlier, which again is interesting. It comes around to the sort of wider modern society thing we were talking about before. And this is the fact that people don't need to work anywhere near as much as people had to work in the past.
Yeah.
Yet it seems like every year people think they're getting busier and busier. Where do you think that stems from? Why is everybody in a rush? Why does everyone seem so busy when really we don't need to work as much as we did before? And that work is not even as strenuous.
Well, I think it's probably two factors. I think there are people who are unhappy in their personal lives and they use work as an excuse. I do think when I reflect back to how my parents, you know, how I viewed them growing up, there were no cell phones, there were no laptops, or there were their big clunky laptops. People didn't have cell phones, or if they did, they were big clunky cell phones and you had to be very special to have a cell phone. And so, and there wasn't this email pressure. So I think people feel a lot of pressure about being, it's like, and it's that duality of being connected versus not being connected. People feel obligated to check their phone, check their email, be hyper connected even when they're on vacation. Whereas before people, you know, you get on a plane, there was no internet, there was no cell phone, there was no social media. So people really could go off the grid and they could enjoy themselves. And so I think it's a twofold issue. Obviously one of concern, but there are also, the third is there are people who like to say they're busy because it makes them feel important.
Yeah, that's very true. I know a few of those.
That's another whole aspect. But I think, you know, maybe being busy or the concept of being busy was attractive at a different stage in my life. Whereas now I'm like, no, it's really more important for me to disconnect. Like I genuinely need to do more of that and less busyness. Like work will still be there. I mean, it was something, a cardiologist I worked with, a female cardiologist who was an incredible human being. And she said, the one thing I want you to understand, there will always be more sick people. That will never go away. But you have to leave and go home to your family. So at, you know, X time, you get in your car, you drive home and you disconnect. And that has always really resonated with me. Now, my family as an entrepreneur might tell me that I work a lot, but I try to keep it, you know, within time constraints. Same thing with social media. I mean, I think that's really critical. I'm not sure if you do that, although you seem to always be, you're very, you know, present, which I think is a wonderful thing, is that you're very connected. But the point being that we have to set up, you know, we have to like provide some boundaries for our own sanity, for sure.
Oh, certainly. Certainly. Yeah. With social media in general, I mean, I've been through lots of waves on them. So, I mean, I was one of the first people on Facebook. I've been on Facebook since 2004.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's impressive.
My university was the first one in the UK that it was opened up to. So this is before Facebook was public. Yeah. So I've been on Facebook for a long time. Before that, I was, at the same time, I was on MySpace. I used to have a big MySpace. I used to have a really big MySpace following, actually. And then Bebo. And then I've been on YouTube since, I've had an account since 2006, but I wasn't always uploading. And then so all of them, Twitter, I've been on since 2009. Like I get people that are like, man, how are you so good at Twitter? I'm like, dude, I've been on this thing for like, I've been on this thing for so long that I am like psychologically connected to it. I know what people react to and how to do things. And yeah, it's been interesting sort of seeing that evolution. But I do wonder, I mean, as someone who looks into the future a lot, I mean, I don't know if you ever do this, but when you sort of look into the future, as especially as a parent, I guess, as someone who's got two sons, right?
Two sons, yeah.
Yeah, two sons. I mean, what are you optimistic about and what are you worried about, I guess, on all of these different levels, from health, both physical and mental, to just, I guess, where the world is going?
Yeah.
What do you feel good about? What do you feel worried about?
Because I have boys, in some ways I'm grateful because I do think it's harder for young women to see, you know, for example, like Instagram, where everything's got 15 filters and they think someone really looks like that photo. I think that it's a blessing and a curse. You know, I think it's a part of our culture. I think that it's unrealistic to believe that it won't be important to younger generations. I think in some ways it's great that they have the ability to be so connected with one another in terms of if they want to learn something or if they want to meet someone that lives in another country, they can do so much like we are. You know, we're connecting, and that's a positive thing. The things that I get concerned about is when I see my oldest is 14, really nice group of friends, but when they come over and I go downstairs, because I'm one of those moms that just, I will make sure I just show up, and I'm pretty tiny, so I can go down the stairs and be pretty quiet. And I keep reminding my husband, I'm like, this will be good for us for many years to come. But when they're downstairs and they're hanging out, and I go down there, and it makes me sad when I see all of them all looking at their phones instead of talking to one another. And sometimes they're messaging one another in the same room. I'm like, what the heck is that? I'm that mom that's like, what are you guys doing? Like, go back to watching that movie or whatever game you're playing. Just go do that and just stop being so disconnected. So my concern is twofold. I think that, you know, it has some wonderful attributes. I think that it'll be interesting to see how the technology piece evolves and shifts. Like, I have a child who codes. Okay. And so it'll be interesting to see how that evolves, and just because he's started to talk to me a little bit about the technology and how he perceives that it could be more beneficial or helpful. But it always goes back to, you know, I worry more when they're dating. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if this Tinder environment is still really Tinder or Bumble or whatever these things are called. Yeah, yeah. Clearly I'm dating myself because I just know the basics, but this kind of disposable society or this disposableness or this, you know, that's a real person that you just swiped over or swipe. Mm-hmm. I don't even know the terminology, but there, that's a real person that you have disregarded or a real person that you're connecting with. And I think that this transactional kind of mindset is something that's of great concern to me. So I think about it more from the mom of, you know, thinking about the dating, you know, are you all going to actually sit in a room and have a conversation, or do you just not even, you've lost the visual cues, the social cues, the things that I grew up with. And even I'm sure you did as well, that this generation is so disconnected from real communication that, you know, how are they going to adapt and thrive? So that's kind of where I come from. I'm curious to think, especially because you've been in the social media realm for such a long period of time, have there been any major surprises for you? Anything that's, you know, either been positive or negative that you was unexpected?
Wow, that's a good question. I mean, what's interesting is that I have seen how they have engineered and changed all of these aforementioned platforms over time to make them more addictive. So most people don't know this. I mean, Facebook in 2004 was like, let's use Facebook. It was a totally different beast. Mm-hmm. Right? There was no newsfeed.
Yeah.
You couldn't make status updates. All it really was each person had a profile. So it was your profile photo. You could upload photos. You could comment on photos. There were no likes. You couldn't like things. There were no metrics. So it wasn't like you could see how many likes something has or whatever. There's no newsfeed. There's no status updates. So it wasn't, and also it wasn't mobile.
Mm-hmm.
That's the big one, right? It wasn't mobile. If you wanted to go on Facebook, you had to go to a desktop or a laptop and use it there. You weren't walking around with it in your pocket all day, getting notifications and whatever. So it was cool. It was this fun thing that you could use to connect with people. Or if you were organizing a university party, I used to use it for my music, right? If I had a gig, I could invite, because it did have the events.
Yep.
So, you could invite people. So you could invite people to the gig and everything and then post up some photos. So that was cool. But over time, it's like I've seen them in the last 15 years just keep tweaking it and engineering it to make it more and more addictive so people spend more time on the platform, introducing likes, introducing the newsfeed, introducing status updates, adding some features from things like YouTube and Snapchat and Twitter. Mm-hmm. And so I've seen that happen. Very similar has happened with YouTube. Yeah. Twitter is the one that's actually stayed the most similar. The biggest change was when they, the biggest change was when they doubled the character limit.
Okay.
And I think that was a great change.
Yeah.
But besides that, Twitter hasn't really changed so much. Like, they haven't engineered it as hard as the others. The like feature, I remember when they brought in the likes. But apart from that, it's kind of stayed the same. So that has been interesting for me to see that process and see how intentional it is, shall I say, because I think some people just think, oh, it's just like that, it's always been like that, and I'm like, no, like they've altered this over time based on all of the billions of users' feedback. They're constantly tweaking their algorithms so you do stay really, really hooked to this thing. and they know what you like. So if I log into Instagram, or my girlfriend logs into Instagram, or you log into Instagram, mm-hmm. what you see is different. If you go on the Discover tab, it's different. It knows yeah. what you're interested in. It knows what kind of stuff will. So all of that's been really interesting for me. And then outside of the world of social media, but I guess somewhat connected, and this reminds me of what you were just saying with that story mm-hmm. with your sons and their friends, is, I mean, when I was growing up, a lot of myself and a lot of my friends, we were addicted to video games.
Sure.
But one of the key differences that's happened with video games is the multiplayer mode. So mm-hmm. when I used to play multiplayer games, we'd all be in the same room. Mm-hmm. So you're all there, you know, you're there with your three friends and your Nintendo 64, and you're all, you know, you've got the split screen mm-hmm. and you're still socially interacting mm-hmm. in the real world. Mm-hmm. Whereas now when people play multiplayer games, they're sitting in a room like this with a headset
yeah.
on
yeah,
and they're by themselves
yeah.
and they might be chatting with people online or whatever. They're technically playing with other people, but they can't see them.
Yeah,
there's not that social interaction. You're not eating popcorn together and yeah. like talking smack with each other when you know. So that whole aspect of it has been largely removed. Lots of games now don't have any local multiplayer modes. So even within the world of video games, it's like even that has changed to become more antisocial.
And that's a good point.
And again, like I don't think most people kind of are aware of that, especially like older people, because they might not be playing the games themselves.
Right.
But as someone who's kind of I'm 33, so I've kind of really seen, I've been right in the middle
yeah.
of that transition. Yeah, I mean, I'm very internet and technology savvy mm-hmm. myself, but I do also remember the pre-smartphone, pre-social
yeah.
media,
yeah.
even pre-internet days. Like it kind of hit right at that time in terms of my age. To me, social media especially, it's just like, it's a tool.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a tool. It's, I think most people use it to their detriment, if I'm being totally honest. I think most people.
I would agree with that.
Yeah. I think for most people, it's a net negative. I think if you harness it well and you use it well, then it's incredible, mm-hmm. right? You can do things on it, like even just through Twitter, the past year, the stuff I've done through that platform and the people I've met, the opportunities I've had on every level, and as well as translating them into the real world
mm-hmm.
has been totally incredible. I could not have done that without Twitter. We wouldn't know who each other were without
Correct.
Twitter and all this. So depending on who you follow and what you choose to put out and also mm-hmm. what you choose to consume, you can let it drive you totally crazy.
Right, right. Well, it's interesting. Someone did a post this morning about being triggered, and I did a post talking about, you were tweeting about the Golden Globes, and so I listened to Ricky Gervais's opening, which was fascinating on many levels. And then someone tweeted about the food, and it was all plant-based, and I have strong opinions about that stuff. And so I tweeted something, and then like three people messaged me who were like hurt. They're like, human beings are not meant to eat meat. I was like, oh boy.
Uh-oh.
I was like, I'm not sure it's late enough in the morning for me to have this discussion. And then they were concerned that somehow they had hurt my feelings. And I was like, you have to understand, I've got a pretty thick skin. I worked in ER medicine and cardiology, got yelled at regularly. And it takes a lot to get me upset. No, that does not upset me. But the fact that there are people who get triggered by almost everything. And I tell people, if you are triggered by the people you are following the wrong person. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about someone disagreeing with an opinion on something, which I think is completely fine as long as people are respectful. But beyond that, I'm like, you're obviously following the wrong people, because I love Twitter. It's probably my only social media platform I'm enjoying these days, but because I genuinely enjoy what people are putting out. And yeah. like you said, it's all about harnessing it for the good and not the evil. And I have no comparisonitis. I'm a mindset of abundance. I'm all
awesome.
About cheering for my friends. But I agree with you that it can be profoundly powerful. Like I never thought I would write a book last year. And I did, with someone that I met, through Twitter, who, you know, I always say is like the consummate alpha dude on Twitter, which is great. Get to get refreshing opinions from him on many things. but yeah, if you use it for good and not evil, as I say, then it can be, you know, it can be really beneficial and enjoyable. But if you do the opposite, then you can end up being, you know, depressed and stressed and, you know.
Absolutely. You really do have to be careful. And both of those things can happen in the course of the same day. I've had days mm-hmm. where it's like, I don't know, I'm having like a good Twitter day. And then like I myself will, I don't know, I'll kind of go off course a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then the whole thing just becomes a war zone for the next 48 hours or whatever. Like I do normally cause it myself. Yeah, I don't know. And it's also just an interesting from a psychological perspective.
Yes.
But yes. I think the most important thing with all of what we're saying here is I think as long as people are able to not lose the real world mm-hmm. abilities to socialize and to talk and to look people in the eye and to establish relationships, whether that's just friendships or whether that's a guy being able to walk up to a girl he's attracted to and mm-hmm. talk to her or vice versa. Like that's the stuff that like, I'm not, you know, I have days where I look like I'm just sitting there, you know, swiping on my phone and doing whatever. But as soon as someone talks to me in the real world, I'm not there on my phone. I make a point of not swiping through my phone when I'm talking to people. I will be looking at you in the eye and we'll right. be having a conversation and I'm forgetting about that other side of thing. But we're now at a stage where especially that younger generation, mm-hmm. some of them can't do that, right? Yeah. They've gotten so used to the phone or the internet being the primary mm-hmm. mode of communication rather than the secondary one. And they haven't really developed those social skills and ability Correct. To talk to people and everything like that. I mean, I've noticed this as well with my music because I used to go out and promote and sell my music in the street. And then I eventually moved into shopping malls. Mm-hmm. So I've met hundreds of thousands of people, just members of the public, Very cool. just out and about promoting my music. And there was a shift, right? I first started doing that when my first album came out in 2006. And this, of course, was pre-smartphone mm-hmm. and mostly pre-social media. And yeah, it was kind of easier to talk to people.
Sure.
Whereas in sort of 2017 and 2018 and whatever, I'd be talking to people and like they're not even looking at me.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. They're talking to someone they're distracted. They're in a different world or sometimes they're literally genuinely afraid to make eye contact, especially mm-hmm. the teenagers. Like you're talking to them and they're kind of like, they're not looking at you. They're sort right. of like looking down to the side or mm-hmm. whatever. And it's just really socially awkward.
Yeah.
And that was a relatively new trend that I started sort of noticing. And I was like, this stuff is affecting people's real world behavior.
Yeah. And think about the impact that has on, you know, when they get out of college, if they go to college or when they get their first job. I mean, the net impact when they're communicating with anyone can be, you know, greatly lessened. I know that, a peer asked me, you know, do you check your phone when you're working during the day? And I said, well, it's different. I'm no longer like in a hospital seeing patients, but I can imagine that for, you know, some of the younger generations that desire to be connected, they probably feel like I'm sure there's some psychological withdrawal and, you know, feeling despondent. And so these are real problems that we will struggle with, or just even watching, like I'm driving through my neighborhood, lots of big, you know, SUVs, lots of kids. Mm-hmm. And I see women that are adults, grown adults, my same age, same peers, and they're in their big SUVs. You know, this is the United States, big SUV. And they're looking at their phone and I'm like, well, what kind of example are you setting for your kids? Mm-hmm. That's a whole separate issue. But I'm like, it's a great way to get yourself into a car accident, but definitely challenging for sure.
Yeah. The law in the US tolerates that way more than they do in the UK. I noticed that. In the UK, that's you will get pulled over and fined.
My kids laugh because they're like, my mom will pull over into a parking lot to send a text. I'm like, that's right. Because if I'm not doing voice to text or if I'm having my earbuds in, I'm like, no way am I texting while I'm driving. I'm like, there's just too many things that can go wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have a family member who was killed by someone who was texting while driving.
I'm so sorry.
So
that's tragic.
For me, it's like an extra, like when I see people doing that, I'm like, you know, it's like someone doing that was the reason why one of my cousins is no longer here. Yeah. So like, don't, you know, it's not a joke. It's like drunk driving and stuff. It's like, whatever it is, it's like, it's always okay until something goes wrong. Right.
Correct. You know? Well, and it's interesting because my youngest got a cell phone for Christmas. He's 12. Mm. And so, you know, it's interesting now that everyone in our home has cell phones and kind of navigating those things. What I find interesting and tying it back to social media is what he's most embarrassed by is that some of his buddies follow me on Instagram. And so he went into my phone the other day and he said, "Mom, I need to change your settings on Instagram." Oh, and I was like, "Why?" And he said, "Because so-and-so can see your Insta stories and it's so embarrassing because they follow you. So they know what we ate for dinner." You're, you know, like, I'm very respectful of my kids. I mean, I don't put them on social media unless they have their permission. But all of a sudden, it's like, oh my God, my mother's so embarrassing because she, you know, put what we ate. Yeah, he changed all the settings so his buddies can't see any of my Insta stories.
That's so funny. I've never even thought of that aspect of it.
Yeah, the embarrassment factor. When it's your parent has a social media presence. It's like, oh my God, you're so embarrassing. I'm like, sorry. That's just the way it is.
That's so funny. So what have you got happening this year? You got any big plans or projects for 2020?
Yeah, I mean, I have a couple things. Primal Man and I are going to get a print book out on primal eating and possibly do some videos connected to that. So that's one. I'm a spokesperson for a company called New Age. So I'm going to be doing some speaking events for them, which is really kind of incredibly cool. Again, one of those things that, you know, how a talk can change so much for you. But yeah, just got group programs. I'm kind of scaling back on my one-on-one work so that I can do more traveling, but joined a big mastermind at the end of last year. And that was a good decision for me business-wise. So yeah, all sorts of good things. And you know, the potential for me writing my own book has come up and I'm still kind of tossing that around in my head. I haven't decided if it's the right time to do that.
Mm. Awesome. And where can people find and follow you online?
Yeah. So www.cynthiathurlow.com is my website. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. I am on YouTube and maybe you can give me some tips on how to grow that following because I haven't invested a lot of time and effort in it yet, but that's changing. But yeah, I'm kind of all over the place, but it's Cynthia Thurlow on all those platforms.
Awesome. Cynthia, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been great to speak with you.
My pleasure.
Sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram. Stunting, you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam. Put some respect on my name. Sick like Cobain, click and I bang. Y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name.
When you need to work quickly and confidently across different apps and platforms, consistent quality communication is key. Whether you're writing documents, emails, or presentations, you need Grammarly. It's an AI writing partner that helps you get your work done faster with better writing. It's always there to help because it works where you work, across 500,000 apps and websites, so you can get more done no matter where you're writing. Grammarly is the gold standard of responsible AI, trusted by millions of professionals for 15 years. It gives you personalized writing suggestions based on your audience, goals, and context, plus tone suggestions to help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. 96% of users agree Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.